This Friday edition is an edited production of an Ethnic Media Services Zoom presentation on the vulnerability of 5 to 11-year-olds during the pandemic. The facts, the services, and the recommendations.
Panelists at our news briefing will focus on 5 to 11-year-olds, one of the most vulnerable groups amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Statewide, fewer than 25% of children in this age group have been fully vaccinated. Speakers today will discuss parental hesitation, the safety of vaccines for children, recommendations for safe in-person learning, even as mask mandates end, and the mental health toll on young children. We are honored to host Dr. Jennifer Miller, who is a pediatrician at East Bay Pediatrics in Oakland, Dr. Sohail Sood, who is the lead for the Safe Schools for All initiative with the California Department of Public Health, Dr. Veronica Kelly, Chief of Mental Health and Recovery Services at the Orange County Healthcare Center, and Beth Jarose, who is the Program Director for U.S. Programs and Deputy Director for Kids Data. Welcome to all our speakers. And now we begin with our first speaker, Dr. Jennifer Miller, who will present an on-the-ground perspective of COVID's impact on 5 to 11-year-olds, parental hesitation regarding vaccines, children, along with her advice to parents. She will also present information about the safety of the vaccines that we have. Dr. Miller, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here. Happy to be here with you all. So what is the impact of COVID on kids 5 to 11 in California? 26% of the eligible children have received two doses of vaccine, and 33% have received one dose. So we're definitely seeing sick kids. I'm definitely seeing kids on the ground in my office that have COVID, and it's a very real thing. A lot of people believe that the kids don't get COVID. They don't get it. We're not seeing it. And what we find is that actually they are getting it. Not as severe of a disease in large part as adults, but they're getting it and they are getting sick. We know that thousands of children have been hospitalized with COVID. We know that hundreds of children have died from COVID. We're also seeing complications from COVID. So kids are suffering from something called multi-system inflammatory syndrome. And this causes inflammation in many body systems, the heart, the lungs, the kidneys, the brain, the eyes. And these cases, while rare, are really impacting communities, largely the Black and Brown communities, and they're affecting children. Often these children are in communities where there's high incidence of obesity and chronic illness. And as of now, there's not a cure for syndrome. We see that kids are missing school. They're missing their sports activities. They're not being able to participate in all the things that they like to participate in. And in communities of color, where often families live paycheck to paycheck, these families, caregivers have to be out of work to stay home and take care of their kids, sometimes for 5 to 10 days. And many of these families are not equipped to deal with this. These families also live in larger groups and larger extended families, which causes increased spread of the disease. So we're seeing that the kids are getting it. They're spreading it to their caregivers in vulnerable communities that are often high risk and suffer from chronic disease. We also see that kids do get long COVID. We don't fully know the extent of that disease, but we know that kids suffer from confusion, prolonged shortness of breath, just not feeling back to themselves, much more fatigue and malaise. We are seeing that in the older adolescents and teenagers. And then additionally, we've talked a lot about the mental health crisis in adolescents and older teens, but I see that in kids 5 to 11, we also see lots of incidents of anxiety and depression. I see kids that are worried about if they're going to get sick, they're worried about if their parents are sick, and now we're telling them they don't have to wear masks as often in school. They're afraid that if they take their masks off, they're going to get sick. So there's a lot more anxiety in the communities, even in elementary school. In the smaller ones, anecdotally, with the toddlers that I see, many of them were kept out of daycare. And so they're afraid to be in a room with me because they're so used to being with their parents all the time and not being with other people. So we're seeing lots of anxiety and depression as well. So knowing these things, knowing these kids are getting sick, knowing these kids are missing out on their normal activities, you know, why are parents hesitating to get vaccines? I think that I find the biggest reason is because they're afraid of the consequences. They're afraid of what might happen to their children. I find that parents are more willing to get the vaccine for themselves. Sometimes they need to do it for their work, or sometimes they need to do it because they've seen other people get sick and have complications. So more adults are willing to get it for themselves. But when it comes to doing it for their children, they find that they're just unable. Just a couple of days ago, I had a family in here, kids that I had never met before that were in this 5 to 11 age group, and the parents had not vaccinated themselves or the children and really didn't want to give the vaccine to the children. They said they were worried that, well, from their research, they had seen that the vaccine actually killed kids. And they were worried that if I gave them the vaccine, they were going to set their children up for a failure, that it was life-threatening. So they're worried about making a decision that's going to have poor consequences. They're worried about causing problems for the future for their children. They're not sure that the disease is severe. They're not sure that they believe that the kids are going to get that sick. And so why should they get the vaccine for their kids? Some families worry that it can affect the fertility or their reproductive years. And there's no data that shows this at all. In fact, all of the data suggests the opposite. They're worried about long-term consequences of the vaccine. Also, we're not seeing evidence of that being a problem. They're worried about side effects for the vaccines. And I'll talk a little bit about the side effects that are happening. But they're just worried that corners were cut in the production of this vaccine. All the data says that this vaccine is safe. It's been rigorously tested. It's safe and effective. No corners were cut. No steps were skipped in the approval of this vaccine. Families worried about allergy and anaphylaxis, although we're not seeing allergy or anaphylaxis in large numbers at all, thank goodness, with the vaccine. And then finally, I think families, especially in our Black and Brown communities, are not totally trusting of the medical community and our recommendations on vaccines. And so they come, you know, with a skeptical brain. They come questioning what we're doing and what we're saying. If I could give any advice to these families, and what I would say to them is, as I just told you, the vaccine is safe. It's been rigorously tested. By the time this pandemic is over, we're going to see that this is going to be the most studied vaccine in history because we're getting so many people getting this vaccine. Parents often ask me about side effects, and the side effect profile is similar to any of the routine vaccines that we give. They often will have fever. They often will have soreness at the vaccine site. Sometimes they can have some redness at the vaccine site. Sometimes they'll have malaise or headache, not feeling so well, fever. But these are normal signs that actually show that the body is building protection against COVID. So it's actually good to have some of these mild side effects. And these side effects are short-lived. They go away by themselves. Versus having COVID, you might have it for weeks and the side effects are much longer. Side effects of the vaccines are short-lived. The disease is not short-lived. So I mentioned that, yes, this disease is often mild in kids. It's not true 100% of the time. As we said, COVID can and does kill kids. It can and does cause hospitalization in children. So as a parent, if you can protect bad consequences from happening to your child, I tell parents all the time, wouldn't you do it? Why wouldn't you do it? We know that this is a vaccine preventable illness. We can reduce the bad complications from COVID. Why not give your kid this vaccine? And then finally, vaccines are free. It's important to remember that you don't need insurance. You don't need citizenship. You can get it from your pharmacy. You can get it from your doctor's office, your internist, or your pediatrician. It's widely available. So please get vaccinated. Please get your 5 to 11-year-olds vaccinated because we want to be able to protect them and keep them safe.
Terrific.
Hello, my name is Plachette, and I am with the SackCultureHub.com as well as the Hub magazine. And so my question, Dr. Miller, I am vaccinated. So just on the news today, they've been talking about COVID and the vaccine, and they're talking about the fourth shot now. A lot of us have concerns, you know, some parents may be scared. Some people are confused because now they're talking about a fourth shot. So I'd like you to kind of explain why is that? How can we kind of inform our family members as well as our audience of this different talk about now the fourth vaccine? What does that really mean?
My answer to that question is, many of us in the medical community feel that COVID is not leaving anytime soon, that it's going to be out in some way, shape, or form for a long time to come. And my understanding of why they're talking about there should be a fourth shot is because the longer we go after having a shot, the more our immunity tends to wane, the less our immune system is able to recognize it. The longer COVID is out and about in the community, the more it can change and avoid the current medicines and vaccines that we have for it. And so with each subsequent, you know, the longer it is in the community, the more we have to protect ourselves. So I think many of us think that every 6 months, you know, I think that it will probably end up being like the flu shot, that we'll have a flu shot every year and we'll get flu and we'll get COVID. It would be nice to go yearly and not have to go every 6 months. So far, we're sort of in a place where we're doing it every 6 months. That's sort of how I understand it, that the longer it's around, the more it can change to try to avoid us, and the more we have to protect ourselves to be able to fight it off.
We move on to Dr. Sohail Sood. Dr. Sood will talk about how we return to school safely, even as mask mandates come off. Dr. Sood, welcome.
Harder hit than others. And work is being done to address those inequities that have been exacerbated by this pandemic, and certainly more needs to be done. So happy to talk about some of the state's efforts on that too. However, given these favorable trends across the board, and based on this science, California's moved ahead with a number of policy updates in schools, and I'll take a moment to emphasize three of those. Number one, starting this week, California transitioned from a masking requirement in indoor K-12 school settings to a strong recommendation. This means we are still asking students and staff to continue wearing masks, just as we stated for the general public a few weeks ago, but the state no longer requires that schools track and enforce this. That said, if any local health department or school district chooses to maintain a local masking requirement, we affirm and support the right to do so. And we've released a document providing a framework of items to consider when making such decisions. Number two, we are also now strongly recommending that schools use or transition to using a notification-based model for managing students exposed to COVID-19 at school instead of a quarantine-based model. So we call this group tracing. And I'll note it's not new. We first released this approach at the beginning of the school semester in January, but what is new is a strong recommendation favoring this approach. And it essentially entails the following. So if someone in class has COVID, that someone should isolate. They should go home and they should stay away from others as described in broader CDPH guidance. But for others in that class exposed to that individual, they can and should stay in school. They should be notified of the exposure. They should wear a mask. They should get tested a few days later and be on high alert for symptoms, but they can remain in school. And the reason for this is really that Omicron is quite different, with shorter incubation periods, with wider spread transmission. We need to rely on approaches that match that. And this approach of more rapid notification, broader notification, rapid testing and rapid isolation matches that better than trying to identify and potentially quarantine those within a specified 6-foot radius. So again, this has been around since the beginning of the semester. Schools did adopt this really going through the Omicron wave. And we've now, as I mentioned, seen a nice downward trend. And many schools are continuing to use this approach. And California is now strongly recommending it going forward, in line with what the CDC is now stating as well, in terms of their approach to contact tracing. And the third point I wanted to highlight is California is going to continue leaning heavily in on supporting school communities. So this change in masking guidance does not accompany any backing off of resources. And if anything, allows us really to focus on longer term prevention strategies. And you know, the main one there is vaccinations. So as it stands right now, any school in the state that wants to host a vaccine clinic just needs to contact us, and we'll work with them to sort all the details out and get it done. They can also work with their local health jurisdiction and a number of fantastic community-based organizations. So there's a number of entities working hard to ensure that these children and the 5 to 11-year-olds in particular can get access to being vaccinated. It also includes supporting school efforts to optimize indoor air quality. And we also continue to provide ongoing robust support of testing programs. So this includes testing done at schools and providing tests when available for kids to take home. So in summary, I think we're taking steps in the right direction. We've come a long way since schools were first shut down 2 years ago. Speaking with, as a parent, you know, my daughter spent her entire kindergarten year virtual. And so I'm very happy that her first grade year is going much more successfully in person. And, you know, by and large, California has demonstrably mitigated transmission in schools. When we compare our, you know, outcomes compared to other states, looking at pediatric hospitalizations, looking at school disruptions. And as we move ahead, we plan on continuing to support safe in-person schooling by really providing the right mitigation framework that supports the active challenges we face. And so with that, I'll conclude.
You're listening to a presentation about the vulnerability of 5 to 11-year-olds during the pandemic.
And we move on next to Dr. Veronica Kelly. Dr. Kelly, welcome. Dr. Kelly will be discussing the mental health challenges 5 to 11-year-olds face during this time.
So our kids, ages 5 to 11 for this discussion, have been impacted by COVID-19 in both obvious and less obvious ways. They have experienced an increase in isolation over the past 2 years because of the way they've changed how they attended school. So they're sitting at a kitchen table with a Zoom and they aren't surrounded with their friends. They interact with their friends and other adults differently. And we've changed the way in which our children have accessed healthcare because we haven't been able to go to the doctor. And that may have led to symptoms of increased depression and anxiety, as Dr. Miller pointed out. And what we've seen nationally, according to the American Psychological Association, is a 24% increase in 2020 for emergency department visits for children age 5 to 11 for a mental health crisis. And then this past year, 2021, children's hospitals have reported a 14% increase in mental health emergencies, and as Beth just pointed out, a 42% increase in self-harm, which includes suicide attempts. Our kids have experienced many losses, including missing the first day of school, changes in their friend group, missing graduation, even if that graduation was from kindergarten. They've missed participating in sports and other ceremonies like quinceañeras and baptisms, and even the loss of a parent or a caregiver to COVID. About 167,000 children lost a parent or caregiver to COVID. Additionally, our kids have experienced a loss of innocence, with a national reckoning over social injustice in our Black and Brown communities and increased hate crimes in our Asian and Pacific Islander communities, increased violence and polarization of America. So our kids have had to grow up fast. And this has resulted in something we call sustained survival mode, which means that when we were locked down, we didn't have a whole lot of activities to do, and we didn't have a lot of healthy things to eat, so we made do. But those continued unhealthy behaviors have led to a decrease in our mental health, decreased physical activity, disrupted sleep, increased weight gain, and a very big increase in concern from parents about their kids. Two-thirds of parents surveyed by the American Psychological Association reported concern about the pandemic's impact on their children's cognitive development. And 57% reported that their child could have benefited from mental health treatment during the pandemic. And finally, trauma is cumulative. That means it piles up, especially in kids. And unless we treat it, it can be triggered by significant events like the pandemic. And then for those of us who are also impacted by historical trauma, the risk for mental health issues is unfortunately woven into our DNA. kids who have experienced adverse childhood events like abuse, neglect, community violence, and discrimination, family disruption before and during the pandemic are at a higher risk for continued mental health problems. And we also know that kids of color and lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender questioning kids, low-income kids, kids who are growing up in an immigrant household, and youth who are involved in our criminal justice and our child welfare systems are also at higher risk for mental health impacts. But there is good news, some. 50 years of research, according to the United States Surgeon General's report on protecting youth mental health, shows that increases in distress symptoms, like our kids have experienced, are common during disasters, but most people cope well and do not go on to develop mental health disorders. But for kids, here's some things kids can do. For children 5 to 11, remember that mental health challenges are real, they're common, and they're treatable, just like all other healthcare issues. There are many ways to get better. And kids should ask for help. Ask someone you trust. If you're having trouble controlling your emotions, if you feel very sad, feel like you can't stop crying, then reach out to a trusted adult, the school nurse, a teacher. It takes courage to do this, but it makes a difference. Build healthy relationships. Making friends and keeping them is very important. Get involved in activities to make more friends because our friend groups might have changed. For kids also to find a way to serve. Sometimes it makes us feel better when we help others. For parents and caregivers, pay attention to your own reactions. Kids take their cues from how to behave from us. So if we are angry and nervous about masking or vaccination, they will be too. Kids pick up a lot more than we think. Help your kids build strong, safe, stable relationships with you and other supportive adults, because research shows that the most important thing a kid needs to be resilient is a committed relationship with an adult. Do your best to provide your kid with a stable environment at home, because kids are sponges. They internalize stress. So pay attention when you start talking about financial concerns or marital concerns in front of them. Try and take kids for a regular medical checkup and look for warning signs and then seek help when needed. Distress in kids can show up as irritability, anger, changes in their behavior, changes in their sleep patterns. So if you see something, let your kid know that you are there. And don't be afraid to ask a health professional for help. There is a lot of free resources available through every county, every one of the 58 counties in this state. Minimize access to means of self-harm. We saw that the rates increased. So if you have guns at home or prescriptions, you need to make sure that they are kept away from kids. Dispose of extra medications that you have in your house. And if you have guns, lock them up and keep the key away from your children. Be attentive to how your kids spend their time on the internet, because it is a way to connect, but it's also a way for bullying to happen and for overexposure to happen to very stressful scenarios. And finally, be a voice in your community. Talk openly, like we just did, about mental health, because we all have it. Our kids and our families can and do recover. Thank you.
We next welcome Beth Jarosz of Kids Data. Beth?
Oh, hello. I want to thank you all for inviting me to this esteemed panel. I am Beth Jarosz, and I work at PRB. I'm program director, and I work on issues of population health and well-being in California. One of my projects is Kids Data, where we track child well-being for counties, cities, school districts, and legislative districts. And today, I'm going to share just a bit about how young children have been doing since the COVID-19 pandemic started. I will start with all children under age 18 and we'll share data for ages 5 to 11 where possible. And then I'll show you where you can go to find more information. First, although public health restrictions are easing, it's important to remember that the SARS-CoV-2 virus is still circulating. What you see in light blue on the bottom of the screen is the cumulative number of child COVID deaths by the end of 2020, by the end of 2021, and March 13th, 2022. The dark blue line shows the cumulative number of COVID-19 cases for each of those periods. Nearly 1.6 million cases since the start of the pandemic is substantial. As you heard earlier, this means children who are getting sick, who are at risk of multi-system inflammatory disease, who are missing school. And that works out to more than one case for every 6 children in the state. And what might be even more startling is that when we look at the number of new cases per year, there have been more child cases of COVID in the first 2.5 months of 2022 than there were in all of 2021. And if we look at the death data the same way, the number per year rather than cumulative, we also see a troubling pattern. Although children are less likely than adults to die from a COVID infection, more than 30% of child COVID deaths across the whole pandemic in California have happened just in the first 2.5 months of 2022. So even if this pace slows, 2022 could well be the worst year of the pandemic for children. One way to prevent child COVID deaths from rising would be, of course, to get more children vaccinated. This chart shows vaccination rates first dose for children ages 5 to 11. California is ahead of the national average at just over 30%, but both California and the nation have less than 1/3 of children ages 5 to 11 fully vaccinated. Perhaps even more importantly, you can see comparing the top 4 and lowest 4 counties in the state that there's a really wide range of variation across counties. We know that there have been vaccine equity issues nationwide, but I want to highlight something interesting in California. Someone earlier on asked what the rate of vaccination was among Hispanic and Latino children in the state. And although I did not find that data ahead of this meeting, we do know that Black and Latino people in California have lower vaccination rates. But you'll notice Imperial County in the top 4, and I want to point that out as a success story. Imperial County, for those of you who don't know, is an extremely agricultural county with very, very high unemployment rates, and nearly 40% of public school students in Imperial are English language learners with Spanish as their primary language. But yet they're in the top 4. Clearly they're doing something right. There are lots of questions about how they've gotten such a high vaccination rate countywide and among children, but a lot of the understanding is that it has been partnership with trusted community partners, and that those trusted voices, you know, as it's your trusted pediatrician, as we heard from Dr. Miller at the beginning, it's the trusted community leaders that really seems to have made a big difference in Imperial County. Really big gaps in between the coastal counties and the more inland and rural counties in California in terms of child vaccination rates. And to me, that's more striking than any of the other gaps that I've seen. There's great room for improvement in terms of child vaccination. Thinking more broadly about the effect of the pandemic on children, was there any good news? We don't yet have data from 2021. But in 2020, we know that fewer children went to the emergency room or were hospitalized, and deaths did not rise in that first year of the pandemic. And we think that's because lockdown measures reduced children's exposure to risk from many sources. There were fewer car trips, there were fewer illnesses. People were less likely to come into contact with the flu that year, for example. But when we start to look into the mortality details, there are some troubling trends. Here, we see child deaths for ages 5 to 9 in dark blue on the bottom. And you see no increase in 2020 or 2021. But at ages 10 to 14, shown in the lighter blue, we see an increase. And it's largely because the number of suicides rose dramatically for 10 to 14-year-olds in 2020, as did the number of accidental deaths, which includes traffic deaths, drowning, and poisoning. And poisoning is often overdose. So there are some real signals here in this data that suggests that there are mental health challenges even as young as age 10 in California and nationwide. The suicide rate, which is not shown on the slide, nearly doubled in California 10 to 14-year-olds between 2019 and 2020.
Thank you.
And unintentional deaths rose by 40%. So while there is some good news, there are still some very troubling trends. And I want to say that we are continually updating kidsdata.org with the latest. If you visit kidsdata.org, you'll find more than 900 indicators of child health and well-being across the state. On the main page, there's a quick link to a special survey we published on family experiences during the pandemic. The most important way to keep up to date with the latest information is by subscribing to our monthly newsletter.
This recording was made on March the 15th, 2022, and edited for broadcast. The Friday edition is a production of KIDE Hoopa Tribal Radio. The production editing by Joseph Orozco, lead producer, KIDE FM. Teskia.